Hey, what's up, friends? You're listening to Millennial Musings, and as always, I'm your host, Anurag Ramchandran. Sometimes people defy the odds and use the bad hand that they've been dealt with in life to do the best that they can and make the most of it. And my guest today, Sarvesh Singh, is an incredible example of this. In our unequal and unjust system, someone with Sarvesh's background has to do far more than the average privileged person to get to the same point. It takes courage, perseverance, and a relentless work ethic to battle your way to the top and be comfortable there. Now, these are the kind of stories that need to be shared. And as such, it is my absolute honor and pleasure to bring on board for today's episode my lovely friend, colleague, and all-around great human, Sarvesh Singh. Let's jump straight into today's episode. It's Sarvesh Singh on fighting the odds, assimilating to your environment, and taking risks to follow happiness. You're listening to Millennial Musings. Thank you for tuning in. Sarvesh, my man, welcome to Millennial Musings. You know, one of the weirdest things about all of this is that ever since I started the podcast, so the first two episodes that I did, I was like sitting down with all my people, you know, like having that eye contact and having those like deep conversations. But ever since that, I've like kind of transitioned to completely entirely recording online for some reason, you know, and add on top of that, like the world going to shit with our current pandemic and I haven't seen people in a while. So not only are you like one of the first people that I'm actually seeing, we're actually doing this in person, which makes it kind of nervous. With, like, you know, you're sitting right next to me right now, looking into my soul while I'm speaking to you. It's kind of scary. But all that to say, welcome to the show, my man. And we have so much to talk about.
Yeah, we do. And thank you. It is nice to sit across a person and talk and not to have be on a Zoom call. So I love this.
Yeah, it's really odd times. It's really difficult times. But it's just a matter of like, how do you get adjusted to all of this, right? Like, it feels weird to me even right now sitting next to you, like an actual real person, because it feels like it's been a really, really long time. It's in fact been like 5-6 months to a certain extent, right? Yeah. What has it been like for you, man? Like, what has this whole pandemic period looked like for you? And what is your outlook for this whole thing?
I mean, there's been different phases. So when it started, we all were hopeful that it was going to like blow out in a month or two and stuff like that. And now it feels like it's never going to go away. And the good thing is that most of the speed I've lived with my girlfriend and we've gotten along really well.
That's a good thing. Yeah, that's a really good thing.
Yeah. A couple of hiccups where we had to like move a couple of times.
Yeah.
But other than that, like it's actually been easy except for like work, and then you have to get used to like working out of your home. You mix your personal and work space, etc., etc. Right, like most of the things that most of our colleagues are going through. But all in all, I've been super grateful. Like it's been easy given how the rest of the world is.
Yeah,
we've been able to order in. There has been no issues with like any of the essentials or the basics.
Right.
Which is
so life is going on in a certain in a very different way, but it's definitely going on.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, especially given all this, like, changes to our lifestyle and all the things, one of my biggest, I think, things that are holding me back, or, like, even to a certain extent that's, you know, keeping my mind active is, like, every time I go to bed, like, there are so many thoughts that are ranging in, right? It ranges from, like, what's happening in the world, politics stage, it's happening about things that I'm thinking about myself, people that I've interacted with, not interacted with. My mind is, like, incredibly active. And maybe that's because of the lack of interaction that I'm having on a day-to-day basis, or even the feeling of being cooped up, you know? So I just want to ask you, right off the bat.
Yeah.
It's like, what's keeping you up at night these days?
I mean, apart from everything that's going on in the country and the world, it's just this thought of if you're good enough and what do you need to do more to be better or to be enough for your surroundings, to be enough with for the people that you're with, for the people that you interact with or the people that you hang out with or work with, especially given like a place like Dalberg where everyone's an overachiever, like everyone's really smart and everyone's type A, as we call it. You have to always, like, at least like for me, I have to be always on my toes to be like, am I good enough to be here? And then what does the next step look like? right? If if the answer is yes, because I am here, then like, what does the next step look like?
Interesting. It's what I'm hearing is a faint sense of like the imposter syndrome that a lot of us go through, right? But on the other hand, knowing your story, I know there's reasons why that becomes a very pertinent statement that you make, you know? Mm-hmm. And just to maybe set this scene a little bit, most people, I would say, at Dahlberg, and I've been there like a little under a year now, most of the people at Dahlberg, you know, come from a certain level of privilege, background, ambition, agency, having, you know, lived lives a certain way, if I may. Maybe different parts of the world, obviously different circumstances, but there's a certain crop, right? As you can imagine with any kind of consulting firm. Yeah. But knowing you, I know like your story is way, way different than so many of us. And that in many ways, it is a tale of inspiration and like pushing the boundaries, taking risks so many times. So maybe we can talk a little bit about it if you're comfortable.
Yeah.
Because for me, especially, I think it's a fascinating experience, like learning about what you'd had gone through.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I love to tell people that I am doing development consulting and I'm a chartered accountant. And that always raises an eyebrow. And it's like, what does that...
What
like,
are you doing here?
Yeah, right? And it was worse when I was doing my Teach for India fellowship. People were like, you're a chartered accountant. What are you doing here? Or when I was working on cancer care at Tata Trust. Similar questions. But the reason why I'm a chartered accountant is very different than why I'm doing what I'm doing today, right? So the decision-making points were different. I grew up in a very small town, which is a village actually, called Kongaon.
Yeah.
It's in middle of Kalyan and Bhiwandi, 3 hours away of Bombay. Mm. Although it's like only 3 hours, it's like culturally way, way different and way behind. So I remember moving to Bombay technically in when I was 14. And a culture shock was that girls my age were wearing jeans.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So from there, I think like because my mom was also single parent and we had just moved, I wanted to be an engineer and I looked at like a couple of colleges and the fee was like 60,000-70,000 a year, which for us at that point was like too much. We just couldn't do it.
Of course.
So at 10th standard, I made a decision of like, the criteria was, what's the best, most respected course that's also the cheapest.
Right.
And the answer is CA. Right. So I took commerce in 11th, 12th, which is what you do in Maharashtra. Because I wanted to do CA. I knew nothing really what CA was. Like, I had no idea what does a CA do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
It just was that it's the cheapest and it's most respected and you earn well, right?
Yeah.
So it was that decision.
It's interesting because I hear a few things in there of what you've already mentioned that puts things into perspective, right? Like, you mentioned that your mom was a single mom raising you and your sibling.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that you came from a really tiny village, moved to Bombay and had to make that kind of like decisions based on, you know, how much, if you can afford the fee or not.
Yeah.
Let's dive deeper into that, right? Like, so what was it like, you know, growing up with a single parent, especially in like a village, and then making that massive transition to a big city in which you'd never even seen girls wear jeans before, you know?
Yeah. So like till I was 14, I had a full family, right? So I had my father, my mother, grandparents at home all the time, right? So it was a full family. And in the context that I grew up privileged, right? So when you expand that context to where we are today, it doesn't sound much, right? But there I was a male, quote unquote, upper caste. My parents were literate.
Yeah.
So that's it's like jackpot right there, right? Mm. So I grew up privileged in that particular community, right? So yeah. But both my parents were primary teachers. But the issue was that my household was domestically extremely violent, right? Mainly towards my mother, right? And her story is that she got married when she was 18. She had me when she was just 20. She had just started working as a teacher. She had my brother when she was 23.
Yeah.
She battled a life challenging disease at 24. And she grew from there, right?
Yeah.
And there had been a lot of incidents, like instance where she did move out for a while, like a month or two, and then she came back because of us, because of the two boys.
Yeah.
But 2006, we were old enough. So I was 14, and it was just, it was done. She was done. Yeah. And it was her bold move. She was like, can't live here. I can't subject my children to this. I can't subject myself to this.
Yeah.
And then she made that move, right? And that changed my life. That changed everybody's life. And that was a really bold move.
Yeah.
She was a BMC. She still is a BMC teacher. Mm. At that time, I think the salary was like 6,000-7,000 a month or something. We moved to New Bombay. Got like one room kitchen on like rent. And the context is like in back in Konka, we had a whole building that we built ourselves, right? So coming from that to live in like one room kitchen, and that's when like decisions changed, right? So I grew up, because I was very close to my mother, I grew up with the sense of that responsibility that I have to do something.
Yeah.
I have to, like, because she has done so much for us and she sacrificed so much, there's somehow it's my responsibility to take care of her.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're like a 14, 15 year old young man who's making such a massive transition in your life and your family's life, right? Like almost being uprooted from like the place that you'd known all your life to suddenly finding yourself, you know, in a precarious family environment and in a precarious, like, brand new environment that you just didn't know anything about. But that's in our context, in the context of India, in the context of Indian villages, that's really, as you said, a very bold move, because you don't see that happen often. And that speaks volumes about your mother. The fact that she just wanted to make your lives so much better and give you guys the opportunity to get away from that kind of environment.
Yeah, and she faced backlash from almost everybody, like even her parents. Even my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, asked her to go back a lot of times.
Yeah.
And in the past, she had gone back because they asked her to, right? Mm. And at this point, she put her foot down. She was like, no. And that, I think that's the boldest move that anyone can pull off, right? To then say that I'm independent and I'm taking care of two young boys all by myself, and you can be against me and I don't give a shit.
Wow. I just have goosebumps even like listening to this. I mean, obviously, you know, we've talked about this before, but it's every time, just the scale of your mom's sacrifice and dedication, it just it makes me miss my mother. It makes me look up to her in many ways. And so, as always, man, thank you for sharing her story as much as possible. But I don't want to, you know, skip over just yet. Let's talk about having been uprooted into this new place as a teenager, as a person that's in that phase of discovering themselves, right? Like, those are the crucial years when, you know, your friends, your family, and every environment around you kind of plays such a crucial role in kind of determining the person that you become in many ways.
Yeah.
And here you are in a brand new place, in a completely different environment. What was it like for you? And how did you go about navigating that situation?
I think, like, in some ways, this burden of responsibility really helped, because it made me focus. I was able to drown out like a lot of other stuff that would have distracted me in terms of like, oh, I'm not good enough, I'm not supposed to be here, etc., etc. But like, it turned into that I have to do well,
right?
And the only talent I ever had was like academic, right? Mm-hmm. I had no other talents, so it all came down to that I have to do well. Like, I have no other option.
Hmm.
So all the stuff that takes to adjust to the new environment, right? And it also comes in a very benign form of like ridicule from the people around you that they don't really intend to hurt you, but they do hurt you, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, I remember at some point I said banyan tree instead of banyan tree.
Mm.
And like five people around me started laughing. And that hits you. Like, that point, it shows you of like, in your head you're like, oh, I am inferior,
yeah,
or like I'm not as good, or they're laughing at me because of who I am, right? And I think like that only pushed me to be like, okay, I need to assimilate, I need to learn, I need to be better, and because the option is, there's no other option, you can't fail, right?
Mm.
And
what does that mean to assimilate in in these ways, right? Like what was going through your mind when you were at that point and like, you know, you're experiencing this where people are making fun of your accent and, you know, maybe your lack of awareness about a couple of things. And it's hard to take as a, you know, young person.
Yeah. And I think like it was one thing at a time for me to deal with. So most of the first couple of years went into being able to speak or have like a proper conversation in English, right? Mm. Because I didn't, even though I studied in an English medium school technically, yeah. I didn't speak any English, right?
Yeah. And that's a whole another conversation we can have about yeah. English medium schools and like the extent to which you actually, you know, pick yeah, up stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And the way I learned English was like I had songs on and I used to see the lyrics of the songs to understand what they were saying. I watched a lot of English movies with subtitles, you know, just to pick up on conversation. And when I went to college and when I started my articleship for CA,
yeah.
there were instances where I just had to. And I think the only way through is like through that ridicule, right? Like through that making mistakes, people laughing at you, and then you correcting yeah. yourself over and over and over. And then suddenly you're at a place where you're very comfortable with it. I think that's with most of the things of how I assimilate, right? So whether it's with body language, lingo, style.
Yeah.
I mean, like when I moved in 2006, I was wearing like bell-bottom jeans yeah, yeah. and like tucked in shirts with full sleeves and stuff.
Right.
And people laughed. And what you do is you start copying. And the first venue of copying is your peers. But then that was also the point where like some media was available, right? Like TV yeah. was available, etc., etc. So you start copying people on MTV.
Which was the cool thing, man.
I mean, I had jeans with so many holes in them, and like it's not even funny. Yeah, I had jeans with that looked like came out of a hardware store because it was just like all pins and stuff. But yeah, that's how yeah, you learn, right? Yeah. Like that's you do stuff, and then when you're in a new environment, you see people how they are.
Yeah.
And then you try and fit in.
That's the struggle with assimilation, right? There's always the question of like, what are you giving up to do that, right? And the thing is, at age 14 and 15, there is no right answer for that, and that question should not be asked to a young person. All they want is to fit into that, you know, environment that they're finding themselves in, like, you know, in your
be accepted.
Yeah, exactly.
But
in a way though, the other way to look at it is that, so on one hand, you know, the criticism is that, okay, why are societies not accepting of people that are different, right? Like, why are we not having that kind of space where somebody who comes from a different environment is welcomed in immediately? That's one way to look at it. And the other way is to talk about like the kind of the why do this, right? Like, so one is like the society's kind of pressure on it, and one is like a personal pressure as well to a certain extent. What do you think played like a more, you know, structural role in, you know, your desire to assimilate or your need to assimilate, especially?
I never thought of it as like it's someone else's responsibility, right? So I actually really like that point that people should be accepting of everyone, right? Like it shouldn't be an issue to go somewhere yeah. and then feel not accepted because of who you are or where you come from. But it's also like humanly very different and very difficult.
Yeah.
Because when you see somebody different than you, who looks different and speaks different, you don't accept that person right away, right? Yeah. Like there's the bit of trust building. I think like what has been difficult for me is that in the whole process of assimilation last 13, 14, 15 years now, there's a huge chunk of my childhood that I've missed and that I've lost, and that I'm just now about rediscovering, right? So when I moved, I loved Hindi, I loved Urdu poetry, and I loved Hindi literature, which I have mostly lost in the last 15 years because I completely shifted to English literature.
Yeah.
I have lost a lot of my touch with like old Hindi songs and like ghazals and just stuff like that, which I'm rediscovering now. But I think that was the biggest sacrifice for assimilation is to, one, to let go of your ego, and then yeah. second, to let go of a lot of things that you own and then relearn stuff. And you only have so much space, so you replace what you had with something new.
That's very interesting, man, because I think the whole experience of assimilation, it happens to a lot of people throughout their lifetimes, right? Like, regardless of where you move to. And it's very different, I guess, from a situation in which it is a necessity. And on the other hand, when it's like, okay, I can try and do this, right? And I guess in your case, it was obviously the former, where it was just needed for you to be able to survive in those kind of environments. But what did it look like in school, right? Like, you're this new kid who's speaking funny, who's trying to assimilate, is every day trying to improve himself. What were teachers saying? Were teachers trying to, like, you know, prevent this kind of, like, separatism from happening? I don't know if maybe if you can tell us a little bit about
it. I don't think teachers noticed or cared. You know, in school and college, like, teachers had a job of, like, coming and completing their curriculum, and they did that, right? There was no effort in, like, social learning of people in the classroom, right? There was no effort into, like, emotional learning of people in the classroom. It was just math, science, English, whatever, right? So I don't think I've ever received that support from teachers after I've moved here. So I don't think that is. And just to the earlier point, I think, like, assimilation also has a huge role in choice when you're moving from the same class to the same class in just a different geography or just in different context versus when the mobility is between classes.
Mm.
So I was definitely moving between two different economic classes and two very different economic cultures. And that played a huge role because assimilation is also expensive.
Oh, 100%. And I think what that speaks to that whole social divide, as you said, and the economic divide that exists. But in many ways, I just want to kind of circle back to our initial point, right? Like, your path has been so unconventional because for listeners that are not based in India or don't know the Indian system, there is what Sarvesh studied was the state curriculum. And what many of us studied was, like, the national curriculum, essentially. And so even within those, there's massive divides. And I think you're, like, one of the few people that we can count on, on one hand, who'd gone through the state curriculum and was working in, like, Dalberg or, like, another equivalent firm. Let's talk about that journey, man, because I think that's something that I'm really curious about, you know, doing your state curriculum. There's a certain kind of expectation as to where that ceiling is for somebody. And then beyond that, there's another entire world, right? How did you navigate that all together?
So I think a lot of it is for, like, because of chance. But what happens is, at least in the context of the state curriculum that I was, that you dream small. Like, you don't know what is possible. You don't know the extent of opportunities out there. So you never even dream big, right? You dream small. So, like, when I was in 10th standard, I could be like, oh, I have to get X percentage, 85-90%, so that I can get to, like, this college in Mumbai, right? And for me, it was like, oh, I can't travel far away from my home because I have to be home at some point. So I have to have this college, which is the best college in my locality, right?
Mm.
It's not even top 10 colleges in India, top 50 colleges in India, right?
Mm.
But at that point, it felt like a huge deal, right? Now when I meet people and they were like, oh yeah, when we were in 10th or 11th or 12th, we were thinking of going to the US for studies. It's like, if you told me in 10th standard or 11th standard that, hey, you can go and do your bachelor's from another country, leave country, another city, I would be like, no, not an option, not possible, can't do that, right? So you dream small. And thing with my movement has been that every time I've moved, the dreams have moved, right? And which has made me push myself harder, which has then resulted in me being here, right? So when I moved to Mulund, did my bachelor's there, I was also doing my CA at the same time. I got an articleship, which was in Dadar, which is like central Bombay, right? Like, it's middle of the Bombay, which exposed me to a lot of things. I was working with people there during my articleship who came from some of these privileged backgrounds, someone who came from one of the best schools in Bombay. And they were like, oh, I want to go for an MBA at Berkeley. And I was like, wait, what is Berkeley? And we had access to internet in the office, stuff like that, Googled, maybe was possible at that point. I wasn't sure. But you just get exposed to more things, and once you're exposed to those things, you think of those things as something that might be possible for you as well.
Right.
You're always a little hesitant to believe it, that you can also do it, but there's this little bit of dream sown inside where you're like, oh, maybe. And when I came to the third year of my CA, the last year of my CA, I was not having fun. I was just miserable. And that's when I took my real first risk to say that, you know what, I will give Teach for India a shot. And it was a very impulsive decision. Everyone was against it because you have to also, like, my mom was against it because from her point of view, I had put in so much of work, and she had put in so much of work to get me where I am. And now I'm at this door when I'm going to qualify as a chartered accountant. I can get a good cushy job and then really help out at home. And then I decided to do this fellowship, which pays peanuts.
Yeah.
But kudos to her. Like, even though she did not support it, but she still kind of supported me in my decisions.
Yeah.
She wasn't for that decision, but she was like, if it makes you happy, go ahead. Right. And I mean, that speaks volume of who that woman is. Right.
Absolutely.
And then after 2 years of Teach for India, I lucked upon one of my co-fellows' sister, who's also CA, knew a headhunter who was looking to recruit somebody for, head of debt securitization for an impact fund in Bombay. And I was like, I don't want to do that. And he's also an animal activist. And he was like, well, there's this another role with Tata Trust, but it's to build a veterinary hospital. Would you be interested? And I was like, crazy. Say more. and then ended up meeting his whole team for like an interview, six people at CCI Club, like a fancy club at Marine Drive, right? Got the interview, got the job, 6 to 8 months in Tata Trust, found this another person who was like, oh, I'm going to start like a cancer care team. Can use somebody like you, would you be interested? And slowly transitioned from veterinary to cancer care for 2.5 years, built my liking for healthcare there. And then met someone who introduced me to somebody at Dahlberg. They were looking for a specialist role at that time.
Yeah.
Got an interview, got that role. Did well in the first 3 months and transitioned to like a full-time role, right? Like, there's so many lucky things that have happened there, but it's also because I was exposed to those parts of the city, right? Like working in Dadar had its impact. Working in Cuff Parade World Trade Center and knowing those people through Tata Trust had its impact.
And it's a beautiful way that you initially put it as well, right? Like with every move, with every transition, your dream got bigger. I want to ask you about this, right? Like, I think it's exposure, as you said, that got you curious, and that curiosity eventually led you to wanting to apply. That application led you to being in that pool that, you know, you probably wouldn't have imagined, you know, previously. But let's take that step back and talk about why people don't get that exposure and why, you know, exposure is also this kind of commodity that is heavily protected and, you know, preserved within certain elitist communities and within certain social strata and economic strata. With your experience in education and having been through, you know, a very trying education system yourself, what do you think it is that's preventing exposure and access in all these different places?
I think it's a very basic human nature, at least that I've found, is that people choose other people who are like them, right? And when you then take that in the context of like an economic class or like a privileged class from an economic perspective or a social standing perspective, then you have this privilege that revolves in the same circles. And then you need someone who breaks that class and makes a forward jump and who's then in a position to bring other people with them, right?
Yeah.
So that's Teach for India is a great example for that, right? So a lot of Teach for India fellows come from privilege, right? A lot of them. And when they are in the classroom, through secondhand effect, the students have a lot of exposure because we had exposure and we were able to tell our students who come from low economic backgrounds, low income housing communities in cities and stuff, And one of my students now wants to be a fashion designer, right? Wow. And I think he can do it, and I think he'll be really good at it. And he's doing internships with one of the startups that an ex-Dahlbergian works with.
Wow.
And he's doing all of these things, right? Like, you see his Instagram, he's in Bandra out and about, and he's got a couple of opportunities with Teach for India.
Wow.
To actually go out of the city and like participate in other stuff, right? And that's how you break the barrier. That's how you get people more exposure, and it's a chain effect, right? Like, his sister will have more exposure now, or his friends will have more exposure if they want to apply somewhere.
Yeah.
They know that their place exists, first of all, and then they know how to. And I think that's all the difference.
Yeah. And it's truly, in my opinion at least, one of the most crucial aspects, even in the development sector or just in life in general. I think access is what is one of the biggest challenges that exists today. And unfortunately, it is, again, so skewed that it takes some people to break those, break the ice, or it takes some people to break the ceiling. It takes some people to take risks. And that's what I want to now transition into, because anyone in a situation that is trying and difficult, anyone would choose the safe option just for the sake of having a fallback in case the dreams don't manifest themselves, right? Like, I think risk-taking essentially, mostly people that have the privilege to fall back and have a soft landing are the ones that take risks more often than people that usually have something to lose. But in your case, though, like with that journey that you mentioned, it's risk after risk, paying off, obviously, but so many levels of risk. What is it that you're thinking through usually when you're trying to make a decision, right? Like, for instance, Teach for India is a risky move from, your cushy salary that you could have secured with CA. After Teach for India, taking another leap of faith, following the path that this headhunter is leading you is another one, so on and so forth. So what are you thinking of when you're trying to make decisions like this?
I think like this goes back to some of the stuff in my childhood, right? Like, so my switch from CA to Teach for India was because I wasn't happy. And I didn't know if Teach for India was going to make me happy, but I knew that CA will not. And it is safe in terms of its economic security, but the option was that I have seen what it's like to be not happy for a long time, right? Very up close. And then the point was, do I choose that for myself?
Yeah.
Or do I take a chance on something else? And when you put it that way, it gets easy. And the thing was, like, I always thought that CA would be, at that point at least, somewhat of a safety net for me. Because even if I did Teach for India for 2 years and I didn't know what else to do, I could go back and start from scratch as a CA from a lower salary and stuff like that. But it would never be a case that I would not have a job at that point, at least.
Right.
And after that, I had Tata Trust, and I was like, this is it, right? Like, if I want to work in the development sector, these are the people I need to be working with. And that's a risk I thought was essential.
Yeah.
If I actually wanted to go ahead and do something in the development sector, because at that point I was like, I like this. Right. I don't want to be associated just with education or teaching just in a classroom. I loved it, but I thought I would make more of an impact in a different role, in a broader role. And I would enjoy a broader role a lot more, like from an intellectual point of view, not from an emotional point of view, but from an intellectual point of view, I would enjoy a broader role a lot more. And that's why the transition from teaching to a Tata Trust or a program role. Right. And after that, Dahlberg was not really risk. I think that was a very cushion. It's a very safe decision, at least. The only risk there was I thought I wasn't good enough, right? And then the risk is of failing,
which is a big risk.
It's a big risk, but there's no other alternative, right? Like, I wanted to move on from the trust, and I wanted to do something else,
right?
And I wanted to. Again, it goes back to, like, I wanted to develop certain skill sets that I thought I did not have. Yeah. And I did not have. Like, it was very subpar. And I, from what I knew of Dahlberg, I was like, this is a place that can teach me that.
Sure.
It means a bumpy road. I mean, sure. But I'm familiar with that, and that's fine. As long as it, like, I have, as long as the learning curve goes up and up, it's the right decision. And I think that was the biggest motivator from now, at least in my career, to say that, okay, these are the skill sets that I don't have, that I need to have, that I want to have.
Yeah.
And what do I need to do for that?
But why the development sector, though? You know, like, these skills can... I'm literally reflecting questions that I've gotten before in my life to you, and maybe you can help me get the answers for this. But why development sector, right? Like, there are certain skill sets that, consulting specifically, that you could have gotten at a BCG or a Bain or, you know, n number of other consulting firms that exist. But what is it about development that's got you hooked on?
It's a bit of self-discovery, right? Like, I'm most happy when I am driven by purpose. And I'm driven by purpose, not by myself, but I feed off of the energy of my peers, right?
Interesting.
And you don't get that in a corporate setting. Like, at least when I was doing my articleship, nobody was driven by doing more audits or doing more taxation. Everyone was driven by, oh, how do I achieve the next milestone in my career? And how do I get more pay, etc., etc., right? There was no secondary... Yeah. There were some people who were chasing excellence. I want to be the best tax consultant or like the best person, best auditor and stuff like that, which I did not relate to at all, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I found in the development sector was that there's a lot of energy and there's a lot of positive energy as well just around you. And I feed off of that, which makes my work fun, and it makes me happy. There's some selfish reason of like, I can tell myself that I'm doing good in the world so that I sleep better. But it's mostly that people around me are so motivated to do something and are driven by purpose and are driven by achieving a positive impact that I feed off of that energy and I just go with the flow. Yeah, and I think I would thrive in any other setting that has that energy. So far, I found development sector does, and that's why I'm here.
Very interesting. And I'll take the credit for your colleagues bringing that, colleagues and peers bringing that energy, if I may.
Yes.
Absolutely not. That's a ridiculous statement to make. But dialing it back again, Sarvesh, I think... there at every step of everybody's journey, right, there's always certain milestones that when you hit, it just feels like the sweet spot, you know, like every journey along the way, like, you know, maybe it's in school, you know, becoming like getting like a head boy position.
Yeah.
Maybe it's in university, being recognized by a teacher and being given that kind of mentorship. Maybe it's in an organization where somebody takes you under their wing and like, gives you more responsibility than your title deserves. What were some of those milestones along your journey where you just felt like without those particular steps or without those particular experiences, you just wouldn't be where you are today?
I think like more than the steps is like the smaller instances that I remember that have really induced confidence, because I grew up as a very underconfident, like shy tiny kid, right? Like in 10th standard, I was like 4'10", 5'5", right? So it was like small, bullied,
right?
All of that stuff, right? But I remember, say, in 8th standard, we had this teacher called Rosie Mathur, and she was our class teacher.
That's a great name, man.
And she was most the loveliest person ever, right? I first time in the class, I got like top ranks, right? And I was feeling good, and it was validated because in front of the class she was like, a lot of people have made jumps, but this jump that Sarvesh has made, and the first time someone has taken my class in the name and not scolded me after that,
right?
And that felt good. And then in the semester when my rank slipped a couple of points, she was like, I'm disappointed because I know you can do better. I know you are much better than this, and I think if you put in the effort. And I was like, I never thought that I could do even this much. Yeah. And who is this person that I actually really look up to says that I can do better, right? And that confidence sticks with you and has stuck with me and took me to like my 10th and 12th and made me work more than anything. Made me believe that I can do better and made me work, right? Another such instance was like in articleship, almost as a joke, the principal partner at my firm said something along the lines was, what is he doing right now? He should be handling like a couple of more cases. He's the blue-eyed boy in the firm. it's almost a joke that he said, but it just sticks with you, right? Absolutely. And gave me so much more confidence as a 19-year-old to actually go and try cases by myself in the income tax department, right? And it's just those small things, right? Like that gives you confidence and makes you push yourself, I guess.
Yeah, I always believe, and I think this is something that I'll take to, you know, my resting place, is that subtle acts of kindness have a much larger lasting impact than, you know, avant-garde representations, right? Like somebody can invite me to the biggest conference in the world and say I've done something great in life versus like Sherilyn Mam in grade 4 who, you know, gave me my first role of responsibility. That's one instance, man. It's a tiny little thing, you know. It's not one that you photograph and keep on your walls or anything like that, but it stays photographed in your minds forever.
Yeah.
And when you said, you know, Ms. Rosi Mathur's, you know, just calling your name out in class and acknowledging your hard work, that just gives me goosebumps, man, because I think I wouldn't be where I am if it weren't for those acts of validation and those little subtle acts of kindness that people throughout my life have, you know, I've been fortunate to receive.
Yeah, and then it just grows from there, right? Like, then it goes from that to me being in Cape Town in a World Tobacco Conference with Princess Diana, Dina, who was president-elect of UICC at that point, and having breakfast with her, and then just getting out of that breakfast meeting and being like, what just happened, right? What just happened? Like, I just had breakfast with a princess. Like, that for me, for somebody like me, who grew up in Kongaon, I wouldn't be able to point Cape Town on a map for the life of me. It's just insane. And I, the same conference, I had, like, champagne that was bought by Mike Bloomberg with the chairman of AXA, the global chairman of AXA, and discussing tobacco investments in Indian insurance market, right?
Crazy.
It's
also like, just going to make a side comment on like these global, you know, world liberal order kind of conferences. As much as I love shitting on them and like, you know, talking in terms of like its ineffectiveness, on the other hand, I love those galas, man. Like, you're all suited up, you know, have like 5-course meals and beautiful people all around you, famous people. But we let ourselves indulge in that for just a second. And now let's take ourselves back from it. What do you think, Sarvesh, are like some of the most pressing challenges these days that we as young Indians are facing in our very own country? And off the top of my head, I can list like 10. I know you've been somebody that's frustrated with these as well. And so if you know, we can just dive into some of those, what's stopping you?
I feel like this might be an echo chamber, but like I feel like even when I interact with a lot of people from my past, right, like people I did CA with, et cetera, there's this push for populism, push for I like this person, so they are always right. Or like I like this ideology, so I will do anything to justify it. And there is this almost a point where we neglect, belittle and even fear intellect a lot, right? Like the pursuit of intellect and the pursuit of just being rational about things. And I think that's what scares me the most. I remember when Abdul Kalam was the president and everyone wanted to be a scientist, you know, like
What happened to that time, man?
I know, right? Like, and I was so young at that point, right? And that figure motivated me to pursue this intellectual journey, to be like, okay, I want to know more. Mm. I want to read more. I want to understand more. And it's fun doing that because there are such cool people like Kalam doing it, right? And I don't see that a lot around me anymore, right? Like in certain circles, yes, in the circles that we are, right? And
yeah.
And I feel like a lot of us then share that frustration where I'm like, I want to have a political conversation with somebody that I did see it with, and he was one of my best friends at that point.
Yeah.
And it's just almost impossible to reason. It's mm-hmm. almost impossible to say that, okay, has there been anything bad in 6 years? Like, is there one policy that you do not like? And they would just put their foot down and say no. And I'm like, that's not reason, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's you liking for a person. And that's fair, right? Like, we all like other people, right?
Yeah.
I was growing up super young when Atal Bihari Vajpayee was the PM. And because I grew up from a background where we loved poetry, and Atal Bihari Vajpayee was such a good poet, I loved him, right? But that doesn't mean that everything that he did today, that when I read about it, that I agree with.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I love him less. But I don't agree with all of his policies or all of his views. And I want to go to a place, or I want all of us as a country to be at a place where that is okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just, like, on a global level, I feel like we've seen this push towards right. And populism and, like, disinformation.
Fake news, man.
Yeah, and fake news is one thing, but, like, calling facts and proves fake news and then getting people to believe that.
Yeah.
Right? This, like, resurgence of, like, flat earthers and... yeah.
It just feels like one of those cowboy western movies, right? Where, like, it's the land of anything goes.
Yeah.
But in a very... very difficult way. I don't know if it's because we are in that age range that needs to care about it more and that needs to be more involved and are getting responsibilities to get more involved. But I've had this discussion with so many of my friends about why did it feel like it was less intense when we were a little younger? Like, why did it not feel like the world was waiting to shoot each other and our friends from home were... you know, arguing with us on a daily basis. Why didn't it feel like that, right? Like, I'm sure these opinions and love for certain individuals and jingoism and all these characteristics existed, but it just wasn't out to play. And now it's all out there. I don't know. What are your thoughts about it?
I think we were not consuming it at the same rate as we do today, right? I wake up and I see Twitter in, like, first 3 minutes of waking up.
Yeah.
Right? And if you consume something all the time, it's on your mind all the time, and you talk about it all the time, and you engage in conflict all the time, right? And because people are consuming so much more, it's so much easier to spread the propaganda. It's just so much easier to, like, say whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
And the memory has shortened. Like, politicians can say something completely fake and 2 days later nobody cares and nobody remembers.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And I know growing up we used to look forward to, like, 9 p.m. DD News. That was our only source of news.
Yeah.
Right?
Or like the morning newspaper, right? Like, where you had to sit and literally spend time and read. Now it's just like at your fingertips.
Now it's I think, like, because we're consuming so much more, we are always in conflict. I don't say that consumption is wrong. I'm just saying it also creates a platform for people who are feeding the content to create all sorts of nonsense that does get consumed and does get gotten taken seriously now. So
right. But on the flip side, Sarvesh, you know, like, one of the things that I try my best to avoid doing is to, like, completely fall into my comfort zone within whatever echo chamber it is, right? And I've thought about this often, like, how did I find my way into an echo chamber? You know what I mean? And in many ways, like, what is it that somebody else that has had the exact same experiences as I have and grew up in very similar environments has completely different outtake and completely different beliefs from what I may have, and that somehow people with those beliefs coalesce towards each other. It's really weird. It's a weird phenomenon. And I just don't know why. Like, I mean, your background and my background are so different. And I would say we largely fall within the same echo chamber.
Yeah. And I am as lost as you are, because where I grew up, it was patriarchy galore, right? Like, it was all sorts of misogynistic and casteism and stuff like. And I feel like my caste is one of the biggest privilege I have, because I never think about it, right? And right. If I never think about it, that's my biggest privilege, right?
Yeah.
And I think, when I was growing up, we used to go back to our village in UP, and I know my father's cousins used to like come and not even joke, like almost seriously say that, oh, your father's like hit a lottery because you're two boys, so you're going to get so much dowry. He doesn't have to pay any dowry. Both your parents are working, so there's just so much more money. And like, as a 7-8 year old, when you hear that, like, it has an impact on you and you think about it. We used to be taken to a place like sugarcane field and be like, as far as you can see, it's all yours. We used to go to village and like people right next to neighbors, basically, who were not from the same caste, would not sit on the charpai if we were sitting on the charpai, and they used to sit on floor, right? All of these things feed into one's mindset. And I don't know why I'm not like that.
Right.
I don't know what changed, because from very young age, I think like one thing that I was very sure of that is I look at my father and be like, that's somebody I don't want to be. Right? Like,
yeah.
He had a big influence on me in a very different way that I did not want to be that person at all. Right? At that point, it came from a place of hatred. Now it just comes from a place of like understanding of who I am, right? And that's been a journey. I have had problematic views. It has taken a lot of unlearning, a lot of learning. And then again, it still takes a lot of unlearning to let go of a lot of things that has been conditioned into us. But coming back to the point, why, I just don't know. It's just, there were some things that I inherently thought were right.
That's the thing, man. You know, like, I've spent so much time thinking through it. Like, why is that right? Like, why is my mind, or like, what is it about what I've read, consumed, thought about? Like, why is X right and Y wrong? Whereas somebody else is also looking at the same thing and thinks Y is right and X is wrong.
I think, like, I'm just thinking about this right now when we're speaking, and one thing that comes to mind is that I don't associate my identity with one ideology very strongly.
Yeah.
So I can move, and I am happy to change that, and happy to change the definition of who I am based on new information. And like, I have been a proud Hindu, which I still am, but like, in a very different way. I understand Hinduism in a very different way than I did before. I used to be so proud to be a man, so proud to be Kshatriya, all of those things. But I was always, it wasn't something that defined me to my core, right? Like, my life experiences, which were a huge part of who I was, and that still forms a huge part of who I am. So this peripheral identity is very flexible.
Where do you think that comes from, right? Because in many ways, that wanting to stick by like the tenets of somebody's followings or a leader's words or whatever it is, it comes from a place of like wanting to belong, right? Like, it comes from a place of community, belonging. And what you said resonates, because if you are comfortable with your core choices and thoughts and tenets being challenged and being amenable and malleable to it, then it says that, you know, you're flexible. It just means that you are going to take in all your information in as unbiased a way as possible, or maybe biased starting with, but are willing to have it change. But where does that come from?
I mean, I can't answer like in very general, but for me, where it comes from is the same thing that I said at the very beginning, is that I want to grow and I want to be like, what's next and what do I need to do to improve myself, right? And that comes from not just introspecting your skill sets in like a professional setting, but also on a very personal level of who you are, what beliefs do you hold, what actions are affecting others. Do you understand others, right? Like, there's such a huge disconnect of like people within India. We don't understand each other a lot, right?
Yeah.
And not to say that you become a saint or something, it's just to be more conscious of your actions and the impact that it can have on others. And then try to make those small changes and be the person that you want to be and be the person that you respect.
Over just blindly following somebody. And you know what, Sarvesh? I actually think it comes from, as you were saying it, it's kind of crystallizing in my head. It comes from a place of utter humility, knowing that you don't know shit, right? Like whatever somebody says, that there might be a truth that is not your own yet.
Yeah.
And trusting and believing it. And I think that's been one of the biggest challenges in the world today, these days, especially when we're talking about all these different kinds of movements that are popping up, our own, you know, situations of struggle in India, you know, in so many ways, right? I think it all comes from being able to just sit back and tell to ourselves, like, there are other people that know things better, and maybe it's better that I learn from them or challenge their thoughts, or there nobody is beyond reproach.
Yeah.
And at the same time, nobody is beyond growth either.
Definitely. And again, going back to our schooling system, at least here,
that's where the roots of all this lie, man.
We're not taught critical thinking. We're not taught to question, right? So I remember this because early on when I started reading a lot, I was basically thinking about, oh, this person who is an expert in their field or like very well known has said something and definitely has to be true.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's the view. Now that's my view, right? Never questioned it, never thought about it from a different perspective, never said that maybe somebody else is saying something else. Let me read that as well. But it just took it on face value, right? And slowly when you get more exposure and you learn more and then you're like, hey, maybe that's not the right one. Maybe this is the right one.
Yeah.
And then at some point you start questioning everything and then you're like, okay, this person, I know you're an expert and I respect your views. But I might not agree with this point of yours, right? And to say that and have that confidence and be like, I don't agree with this for XYZ reasons. Mm. And if you show me the reasons, I am very much okay to say I was wrong, right?
Yeah.
But to then to be able to then critically think about stuff and say that I need reason to believe something like this, or I need evidence to believe something like this, or where does this come from, or like just to probe further and not take things on their face value. I think that's the best thing that our schooling system can teach. And I realized this very later. And when I was doing my Teach for India fellowship in the second year, I was like, where my kids come from, there's so much propaganda and there's just so much misinformation and stuff like that. My first semester in my second year, we spent reading Animal Farm. And I was like, everyone loved the pigs when we started with it, right?
And
it's slowly. Just like, look at the propaganda, look at the propaganda, and then read the news, right? What do you think of the news? Do you think that's true? Why do you think people are saying what they're saying? What do you think the agenda might be behind a news channel, right? Nobody's infallible. Just think about what could be the underlying factor of this and then make a decision for yourself. Mm. And just to say that different stories exist and how people mold stories. We were also studying Indian independence, right? And there was a lot of fun in the classroom, at least for me, from a teacher's point of view, as a history teacher. I loved it. And we were doing a topic on the 1857 revolt. And we all loved it. And we were like, yeah, we did this. It was great. We fought. And when we were over with that, I circulated a very small sheet which was titled The Sipahi Mutiny of 1857. I mean, that's what the British called it, and that's their perspective. And what they've chosen to highlight is that we murdered the families of the officers and we threw them in the wells and stuff, and we did, right? And we had our reasons. It's not all right, it's not all wrong, but there were different perspectives, right? Am I proud of 1857? Yes. As an Indian, of course.
Yeah.
Do I think killing the women and children was wrong? Yes.
Yeah.
And to be okay with that, right, is what we need to teach our children. Teach the people in school and stuff, right? So in Britain, you don't learn about Jallianwala Bagh and how people were murdered and
their
stuff.
Their colonial education, their education is so colonialized still to the extent that it hasn't been decolonialized yet. Like, not just that, I think even our education to such an extent is, such a great extent is like, still colonialized. It's not decolonialized at all.
Yeah,
I know we've been joking about the term head boy, but it comes from the colonial, stratific school prefect and head boy and all of that comes from there.
Yeah,
but I mean, obviously, a much smaller example than the one that you're talking about. But in terms of media, right? Like, I think there's two ways to look at it. Democratized media, meaning that every voice is heard. Democratized media, meaning that every voice can be opinionated in a certain direction or not, to almost the extent that we just don't have unbiased. I would say it's almost hard to say somebody's unbiased today in any form of media or anything along those lines. Not to say that people from the 60s and 70s and 80s didn't have their own bents of, you know, politics or whatever.
Yeah.
How do you trust media today when your president is saying that these are liars and false and whatnot, and so your some other prime ministers say that these are the best, listen to these channels or only these people. Yeah. And then you have the, you know, absolute mindfuck of a platform that Twitter is, which just feeds you in all different directions.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile all this?
I think, like, from that point of view, I see that which media is most comfortable speaking truth to the power, and that power changes, and have they been consistent with that, right? So if someone was asking really difficult questions in 2012, are they doing it today? If they're not, then I don't trust them. And I think a lot of news and media is about that. It's about it's the fourth pillar for a reason, right? Like, it's to keep other executives and, like, elected members in check. And to ask them those questions that citizens have. They are our representatives also in some form or the other. And if they're not asking that question, then they're not doing their job. And if you're not doing their job, I don't want to listen to you. As simple as that.
But what if on the flip side, as we've been experiencing in India, where the leader of the state does not open themselves up to the media for fear of, you know, being apprehended for all the misgivings of his administration, and instead choosing and opting to go, quote unquote, directly to the public with so many different channels.
No, but you also see that in programming, right? So when there's a reporting, look at last 60 days, right? You'll see very easily which news media has talked about the floods that we have had in this country and the impact of that, or the cases that have risen and the amount of livelihood that has been lost. Or that the projection that our GDP might go negative this year and stuff like that, versus how many have talked about other stuff that doesn't really matter, you know? Yes, we need to investigate whether Sushant was murdered or was it a suicide, but dedicating 1 hour every day for, like, weeks, like, as a country, have... In front pages. And as a country, we have a lot more questions to ask, right? And not to say that that's not important, but you have to balance it, right?
For sure.
If you're not balancing it, that means you don't want to talk about the tough stuff, right? And that's sad, and that's where we are now. And the good thing is there are some independent media agencies, but the problem is their reach is very poor, right? Their reach is elite. Their reach is English speaking. And we are not an English speaking country, right?
Not by any means. Yeah.
We're multilingual. And what are these regional channels do matters so, so much more than what The Wire might do, right?
Yeah.
And I think they recognize this, which is a good thing. But if you're not speaking truth to the power, if you're not bringing up those difficult conversations in your news reports, I mean, it's okay if the Prime Minister is not coming on these news channels. I mean, it's not okay that he has not given one press conference.
Yeah.
But we need to have their representatives, the party representative, ask those questions, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're not, then we're not doing our job.
Do you think it's important to reach across the aisle to have conversations and reconcile differences? Or do you think some people are just beyond saving, as our Twitter and Instagram and other social media, you know, police individuals?
I think it is important to reach across the aisle, right? It is important to have that conversation. It is important to understand each other. But as you were talking about, some people who are beyond conversation, they need education, right? They need to be exposed to the other narrative from an unbiased perspective. And I don't know who can do that in this ecosystem. But they do. You can't write people off, right? These are still people in a democratic country. What we often forget is we are a democratic republic. Mm. We are governed by a constitution. So the majority doesn't call the shots. It's the constitutional rights that call the shots, right? And that needs to be taught. And there's a lot more that needs to be easily accessible information. And I think at some point you'll be able to have a conversation with everyone. But in the current scenario, yes, there's some people that you just can't have a conversation with. Yeah. That doesn't, I wouldn't write them off. But
you wouldn't be as easy on them either.
I wouldn't have a conversation with them. Yeah. Like for the sake of my own mental health. Mm. Because these things do take a toll on you, right?
Absolutely.
So I wouldn't engage.
Yeah.
But would it mean that I don't care who they are or what happens to them? Absolutely not. Like, I do care about them, right? Even somebody who has completely opposite view as mine, like something that I actually think is extremely problematic, but is, if there's some injustice done to them, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the same view, right? Like, you can do that to any other person and it's still injustice, right? And that we need to acknowledge and say that you're still my fellow citizen.
Yeah.
And in all the Twitter jest, I might hate your guts,
yeah,
but you're still my fellow citizen and that doesn't change. So I don't write them off, but it sometimes you just don't engage.
Yeah, so like I get it on a principle basis, right? Like that makes complete sense. Agree with you 100%. But what we're also seeing is like a world in which power structures are evolving in many ways. And, you know, previously traditional sources and centers of power or powerful people are being taken down through powerful, you know, individual sometimes led movements or like public led movements, right? Like Me Too comes to mind as one of the big ones. Recent, you know, accounts of like really powerful individuals being called out for all their digressions, right? Whatever it might be. But there's also an ugly term emerging, right? That is starting to polarize people all over again about cancel culture or like, you shouldn't speak or they shouldn't speak and whatnot. And that term annoys me, you know, like that whole term is already presented in like a negative sense, right?
Yeah.
Like it's got a connotation already that saying those words means that somebody already has an opinion either way, right?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on it, like specifically, and whether or not things are just as black and white, or does that gray area deserve, you know, a certain amount of due diligence before somebody is cut off from?
That is so loaded. I hate cancel culture, the term, because there is no culture, right? Like, if you see it, like, so many powerful people who've been called out, nothing's really happened to them. I mean, like,
yeah, I remember the Harper's magazine letter where all these like powerful writers were just like, like, I'm scared of cancel culture. No, you're not. Like, you've literally held on to power all this time.
Yeah, nobody's taking away J.K. Rowling's money, right? MJ Akbar is still doing well in India. Like, nothing's happening to him. The only person that has ever suffered, like, in public is, like, maybe Harvey Weinstein. But, like, that's the level of digression that you had to get to to actually being held accountable, which is just insane. And I think people should be called out because that affects our behavior as people, right? Like, as a community, it affects our behavior. Even if that means that the person who did something 10 years ago and has now unlearned it and has grown out of it, doesn't mean that they are still not accountable for their actions 10 years ago. And if they've actually unlearned it and have grown, they will take responsibility, correct it, and move on. And nobody's going to say that, oh, you're cancelled and like we're going to take everything away from you and you can't do anything ever.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist, right? Like it's a big world. You might have like a bad time in your career for a year or two.
Yeah.
But you get back. I mean, like Louis C.K. is releasing videos and stuff like that, right? So, there's no cancel culture. It's like still a power structure that exists, right? Yeah. And the power structure plays in like who gets the opportunity to say what.
Yeah.
And we've seen that power structure being broken a couple of times now. That's it, right? And people are losing their mind and just kind of funny.
And even at like the most minuscule level, if it deters one person from, you know, groping another person, or it prevents one person from saying a terrible term or a terrible derogatory term, I think that is a net win for society, where it has that restrictive action, at least, like deterring people, or maybe the fear that is alighted in them is not a result of like natural, you know, realization, but at least, you know, it starts off where, you know, saying something or doing something is taboo, will have repercussions. I'm not going to get away regardless of my race, power, money, gender, and that there are repercussions. But yeah, I agree with you. Like the term cancel culture makes it sound as if like there's this like individual sitting behind like on a bus, on a colorful bus, smoking up weed and just talking about like, you know, we are setting the cancel culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the issue with it is like people, the groups that bring these up also are founded with such ulterior motives generally. So if you take the example of India, right, there's 498A, if I'm not mistaken, it's against dowry, right? And it's a landmark legislation where someone can be arrested without bail, right? And it has largely had a great impact, right? I mean, we still suffer from a lot of these issues.
Sure.
Like, that doesn't mean the issues are gone. Does that mean there have not been cases where the law has been misused? Yes, right? Small number of cases, yes. And those victims matter.
Yeah.
And those victims need justice. But what these groups then do is like highlight those victims and then negate the whole legislation, right? Yeah. If you find a fault in a legislation, you need to tweak it. You need to repeat and make it better again and again so that you avoid such situations, not completely negate it and make and vilify it and say that, oh, this is bad, or like women are doing this. And it's just like so stupid, because if you see the positive side of it, the impact that it has had, right, on correcting an issue that has existed for hundreds of years in this country, that's, it definitely outweighs. And when you say that like that, it sounds bad, but it does outweigh on a social level, right? That doesn't mean that nobody
misused it,
right? Like, and that does mean that victims of that misuse also need attention. But they need their attention in their own capacity, not as to negate the other victims who are actually benefiting from the legislation. And I think that's what like the MRAs and stuff keep doing, that they always step in when they want to negate what the other side is saying and not actually put up issues that men face, right?
Yeah.
And that's where the cancel culture stuff comes from, right? It's something to negate the positives that the other side's making. And I say the other side here because like it's always the tassel between the MRAs and the, they call the feminists and stuff like that, right? But it's that, it's just that it comes because they want to negate the things that are happening and the power structures that are changing. If they were really serious, like there are a lot of issues that men face because of growing up in a patriarchal society, right?
Which they don't want to talk about,
right? Like, these are very difficult conversations, very emotionally vulnerable conversations that I've had over the years with myself and with others, and have found so many problematic things, right? And so many things that I had to unlearn and relearn just for my sake and my health, and be okay with things that were like not masculine and stuff like that, right? Like mard banja type stuff. But all of that needs to be brought in its own right. So if people have issues with freedom of expression, being undermined, that needs to be brought on in itself, saying that there needs to be certain framework for freedom of expression, not saying that, hey, your freedom of expression is actually cancel culture, so don't do it. It's just so stupid.
It's also largely whataboutism, right? Like when you bring up something like, but what about X or what about Y? It's almost in a way kind of like you're pulling a magic trick, right? You're making it disappear issue by like diverting somebody's attention to something else. And I think that is honestly one of the biggest problems. And I'm happy to say call it out as a problem, because I think whataboutism is just one of those like defense mechanisms, like unwillingness to engage with the actual content that's there. If you want to engage with it and disprove it, sure, engage with that topic.
Yeah.
You know, I'm as much as that annoys me, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But it's especially taxing, and just especially on social media, seeing so many people go on and on and on about, you know, their values and this and that. It's just like, it's just a hellhole sometimes.
Yeah.
But speaking of hellholes, how do you sometimes get yourself out of those ruts? You know, when you're looking at the news and Twitter and it's all shit, and sometimes your work is just difficult, and sometimes, you know, your friends are just being terrible human beings. What do you do to escape those little moments?
Tell me when you find something. but what I do is, it's good to go back to simple stuff and to comfortable zone. And that really helps me, at least. So like this morning, we had some guzzle on in the background. And it was just like singing along. I'm a terrible singer, but I love to sing along. Right. So I was just singing along, just being goofy and stuff like that. Sometimes it's like a hot plate of dal khichdi, and just take your mind off of things and like get away from it for a while. Focus on other things. Do something. You know, read something or listen to something. Watch something that's not related to this stuff, and basically indulge yourself a little bit. I think that helps. When I used to in the past, a lot of exercise helped, but that has gone out of the window. But I think like for me, running used to be the thing. So I've done like 3 half marathons for Bombay and stuff. I think that used to be my go-to at some point, is to just like put on music and just go for a run.
Man, I think that's something that, as you said, if somebody finds out like the antidote for it, I will 100% take it, because mine ranges from like, I often joke about doing podcasts as therapy, you know.
Yeah.
And, you knew this because yesterday I messaged you, right?
Yeah.
At the thick of like me being like completely bombarded with work, feeling like I have no time for anything in life, unable to cook, unable to exercise, and having to work on the weekend. And then I'm like, wait, what can I do with like Saturday evening when I'm done working?
Yeah.
All right, let's text. It's therapy time. You know? But I'm glad, because in many ways, what isolation has made me realize is that social isolation, at least, has made me realize is that I definitely undervalued what people meant to me in terms of like helping me pull myself out of the rut that I'm in. Sometimes it's as simple as really busy day, just going and like hanging out with somebody, getting a tea. Or just going on a walk, or like literally just sitting at somebody and make fun of them, put a post-it on their head, like I've done to you many times. You know, it's stuff like that made me just value the little things in a weird way that I just didn't value previously, I guess, of people. And so I'm thankful that you've done this podcast, but I'm not willing to let you go just as yet.
Of course.
What are some ghazals that you recommend that some of our maybe non-Indian friends who are listening to the episode can type into, maybe with spelling? We'll put it on the show notes, of course. But actually, I'm asking for myself, to be very honest. let's be real. There's no friend here. It's all me.
So the two that I've been listening to on loop today is both sung by Ghulam Ali. One is Humko Kiske Gham Ne Mara, and the second one is Hangama Hai Kyun Barpa.
Okay.
Both have beautiful ghazals.
Are these available on Spotify or do yes, I have to do some
are.
More digging?
No, yes, they are available. But if
Spotify,
you
if you're listening, that's your mention. And I would expect some dollars in my bank account for that. You're welcome.
Yeah, they so Spotify does have like some decent collection of ghazals now,
okay.
Which is just really helpful. But yeah, this morning I was listening to Jagjit Singh singing Wo Kagaz Ki Kashti. It's a beautiful ghazal of like, I want to go back to my childhood and I would give anything for it. So it's basically Wo Kagaz Ki Kashti, Wo Barish Ka Pani Lota Do stuff, right?
Yeah, I think almost reminiscing.
Yeah, and it's so funny to think about it because when I am not thinking in context of that song, I always have like negative things to think about my childhood, like all the things that went bad, my family, this and that. But when I'm actually listening to that song and thinking about it, I'm actually thinking about like making paper boats in monsoon or like, you know, just like playing cricket next to the creek in the monsoon and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's just the power of poetry, I guess. And yeah.
Absolutely, brother. Honestly, thank you so much for sharing your story, man. Like it's one that's shown that perseverance and being prepared for the right chances and opportunities just can do wonders for anybody. And my biggest takeaway is that somebody that realized that happiness was such an important component of life early on because of your mom's move and like your mom prioritizing that and seeing you choose happiness at every step of the way, regardless of where you are at that time or how safe you are, always moving in the risky direction, which I know you wouldn't call it risky because it's towards your happiness. That really inspires me, man. And I'm looking forward to making that like a critical component of my life as I move forward as well. But as we wind down, what's next for Sarvesh? Like, what is Sarvesh thinking? What is he planning?
So Sarvesh was planning to go to London 3-4 months ago when the lockdown hit and actually work with King's College and NHS there, which is probably not happening anytime soon. What I'm really looking forward to is actually building myself in Dalberg now, because I do believe in a lot of work that we do.
Yeah.
I really, really appreciate the people here. Right?
Absolutely.
All said and done, like, I don't think anybody doesn't have an impact mindset. Like, everyone wants to do good and everyone not wants to do well in their role. So I feel like it's a place that pushes you, but also towards that thing that you want to do.
Absolutely.
So for now, I want to stick around. I want to see where this goes. I want to see the experiences that I get here, work with more people in the firm. And see where I am in 2-3 years
and create some impact in the development sector.
Hopefully.
I wish you the very best, Sarvesh, as always, such a pleasure. Thanks for joining us at Millennial Musings.